We are welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on the court's oral argument calendar this morning is in the matter of the welfare of the children of AHN and LV. We're hearing the argument on the Zoom platform this morning. The procedural rules are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes to present his primary argument. Appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. Please be mindful of the timekeeping mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen, as well as any attempt by a judge to ask a question. They'll do that by politely interrupting, using the raise hand symbol, or actually raising their hand. We'll give each attorney 1 to 2 minutes at the beginning of his argument to set forth the legal issues for this court's consideration. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs. We're familiar with the procedural and historical facts. So if you could limit your discussion of the facts to those that are relevant to the legal issues, we'd appreciate that. And if we have questions about the facts, we'll ask. It would be a good idea to mute yourself when it is not your argument, so we don't pick up any background noise, as you suggested, Mr. Mack, that could be disturbing. And with that, we are ready for arguments from appellant's counsel. Would you state your name for the record and begin your argument?
John Mack for appellant. I'd like to start out with two relatively technical issues. The first problem that I have with the way that the court proceeded here relates to Rule of Juvenile Protection 302. That's the rule that permits a court to take judicial notice of various orders in the CHIPS case. And the problem with what the court did in this case is that the orders of which it took judicial notice were not final orders. One of the matters which comes up often in what we would call res judicata law is when you can and when you cannot use something from another case. And the cases are consistent that it has to be a final order. And the reason it has to be a final order is that you can appeal a final order. In this case, however, the judicial notice that was taken of something that Ms. HN could not have appealed. And therefore, she wasn't given an opportunity to test it before the court used it. Now, one of the oddities, pardon me?
Yes, Mr. Mack, can you cite any case law in support of that proposition that in these particular types of proceedings where there are specific rules in terms of taking judicial notice of those types of cases that they have to be a final order before a court can take judicial notice of them?
Obviously, there are cases such as the one that I cited, Phil versus Modern Erecting Company, which are in ordinary civil cases, which say that there has to be a final order. Rule 3.02 simply says, may take judicial notice only of findings of fact and court orders in juvenile protection court file. It doesn't say what kind of order or whether the order has to be final or not. I submit, therefore, that in interpreting that particular language, the language has to be interpreted the same way as it is in all civil cases other than TPRs, viz. It has to be a final order. I'm not saying that the rule is unconstitutional, but I'm saying that if it is not interpreted to mean final order, appealable order, then it would be unconstitutional. So I submit that this court should interpret that particular rule to mean final order. Second point that I want to bring up is that finding number 7 is inconsistent with
Mr. Max, Judge Larkin, I think Judge Siegel had a question for you before you go to your next point.
Yeah, just a quick one. So the right of appeal from the order here, does that satisfy due process? I mean,
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. Obviously, there's a right of appeal from TPR, and I did that. But there is a right of appeal from a final CHIPS petition too.
Right, but I mean, you can challenge those findings on appeal, or is it that the record is not there and available to you to be able to effectively challenge the CHIPS findings that the court took judicial notice of on this appeal?
Well, in this case, there wasn't a CHIPS final order that could have been appealed. At least there wasn't at the time that the TPR matter began. So I submit that the problem is that there was no final CHIPS order.
Counsel, could you explain that? Why wasn't there a final CHIPS order that could be appealed?
Because the TPR action was started while the CHIPS matter was still in process.
Yeah, well, what are the rules for appealing a CHIPS order? I mean, obviously there are deadlines. Are you saying that there's a rule that says you can't appeal a CHIPS order if a permanency pleading has been filed?
No, I'm not saying that, but I am saying...
So why couldn't... The question I have is, at the time the court took judicial notice of the CHIPS order, had the time for appealing the CHIPS order expired?
I'm not even sure that there was at the time a final order in the CHIPS petition. I could be wrong about that.
Well, if there was a CHIPS finding, there had to have been an order adjudicating the kid's CHIPS, of which
that's true. But that is the order that would be appealable. Ordinarily, what would be appealable in a CHIPS case would be the final order indicating that the child is in not only in need of protection, but that several other issues had been involved in it.
The CHIPS petition, as someone who sat on the rules of juvenile protection procedure at the beginning and throughout, that's surprising me. So I'll look at that while you continue.
Okay. The second point that I'd like to go into is finding number 7, the judge found that there was not substantial continuous neglect of the children. And it seems to me that if you have a finding number 7, that there is not continuous neglect of the child, that's going to be inconsistent with palpably unfit. And the reason I say that is because if a parent is involved in the child's life, if they are giving them continuous care, if they are not neglecting them, if any neglect is not substantial, then why are they palpably unfit? What the court had to say about that is rather interesting. The court said, petitioner failed to meet its burden of proof, petitioner, of course, being the county here, regarding the allegation of substantial, continuous, or reputed refusal or neglect to comply with the duties imposed upon the parent by the parent-child relationship. Particularly, the petitioner failed to establish that Ms. HN is physically or financially able to comply. The allegation that HN's parental rights should be terminated pursuant to 260C301 sub 1B2 is dismissed. So since the court made such a finding, how could there be a determination that she is substantially unfit?
Mr. Mack, that's a completely different subdivision.
I know it is. My point is, though, that if you make that substantially different finding in a different subdivision, then that would be inconsistent with particularly the findings that were made.
But you're making a generalization on that one in the general language up on top without looking at the specific language that follows it that differentiates that subdivision from the one where the district court did find her palpably unfit.
But they found her palpably unfit basically on, frankly, I think, because she was using THC. There were some efforts made on the part of the county, but I think it's fair to say, if you read the record as a whole, that she was trying, that she'd missed some appointments, but that she made some appointments, that she was consistently in touch with them, and that she related well to her children. So it seems to me that that is why, even though these are different paragraphs in the law, that she's not palpably unfit. One of the things that troubles me about this case is there's a lot of blaming the victim that's going on here. Ms. HN obviously was abused as a child. Terrible abuse on the part of her own mother, a bad foster care, and the court uses this regularly to show that she's palpably unfit. It seems to me that if you're going to make statements like that, you have to take into consideration how much more efforts would have to be done on the part of the county to ensure.
Mr. Mack, I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation of the district court. I think the district court was actually very sensitive to the trauma that she went through and radically acknowledged that. And I don't think the district court was criticizing her. To the contrary, I think the district court was acknowledging all that she had gone through in her own childhood, but use that to put into context that the neglect that she, the district court found she had with respect to the child was a reflection of the fact that she didn't view that abuse as that. And that was part of her way of reconciling the abuse that she had experienced herself.
Frankly, I'm not sure that what I'm saying and what you're saying differs, because it seems to me that the court is saying, okay, she's had this horrible childhood. But then it goes on to say that this is a reason why she isn't capable of parenting now. And therefore, I think that the argument is that she is, whatever her intent, using that against her. I would go on to say a couple of relatively
minor... I don't know if the district court is using it against her. I think the district court relied on the testimony and the evidence that had been presented as to what had occurred when the children were in her care. I don't think... I didn't read the district court's summary of her background to be that something that the district court used against her.
Well, let me give you one example of where I think this happens. The court is really exercised by the fact that she has multiple male partners, that she hasn't been consistent or she has not been good in the taking of her male partners, that you have men coming in and out of her life. Clearly, that is something that A, is part of her background, and B, that the court is using against her.
Well, Mr. Mack, if I might stop you there, I think what the district court was doing was noting that the relationships that she was in were ones that were showed signs of her codependency, that she was in relationships with people that had engaged in drug use, did not have any rights to contact their own children. And rather than recognizing that she may actually be putting her own children in danger by exposing them to these partners, that she actually rationalized and discounted the issues that her partners had. It wasn't, I did not read that as a criticism of her having multiple partners. It was more who she was choosing to have relationships with, and more importantly, who she was exposing her children to that could put them in danger that she did not recognize.
Well, what I would take issue with there is there certainly one of the male partners was heavily abusive. There's no doubt about that. But she goes on, and here I'm talking about the judge, goes on to condemn her having multiple partners, even and she doesn't say that the problem with the multiple partners is that these people are abusive with her kids. She simply says that she has multiple partners, one or two of which were problematical with regard to the children. Now, going on to one of the issues that the judge is comes down, I think, fairly heavy on is drug abuse. And the only drug that I was able to see that there was consistent abuse on is THC. Obviously, we're in a transition in Minnesota. We have not legalized marijuana for recreational use yet, but we have obviously for medicinal use. And I think, therefore, it's incumbent upon a court that is going to be using drug abuse as a reason for termination of parental rights that it show a relationship between the drug abuse and the inability to parent. We don't
wasn't
have that
there
here.
Some connection. It was more about sobriety, wasn't it? Kind of regardless of the intoxicant. I mean, that's how I think that was the concern of the testimony in terms of, you know, did it make her less observant? Did it make her less conscientious? Did it make her, and then could you just address for a minute the issue of reasonable efforts of the county? I mean, that, I know you've got serious objections to the manner in which the judge drafted the order, but let's.
Sure. I would indicate that the judge in this case didn't take any account of her efforts to improve herself, to be with the children, and so forth, that the efforts to comply were continuous. She was in therapy. She was starting therapy. She made many of her appointments. She kept in touch with the county people. I wanted to add one more thing before my time is up. In the case of MAH, at least, the child wasn't an out-of-home placement. She was placed with the father, who had shared joint custody with her during the period before the children were taken from her home. So in this case, the MAH was not out of the parental home.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Mack. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Please identify yourself for the record before proceeding with argument.
Thank you. If it may please the court, this is Shane Baker, Candiac County Attorney, appearing for the respondent. In the reply brief and in appellant's initial brief, they indicate that the court improperly determined that the mom was palpably unfit. County submission is that finding of unfitness was not an abuse of discretion. The court relied on many issues and factors on that. I think first and foremost, throughout all this, it wasn't the drug use that concerned the court. It was the failure to follow all the items in the parental capacity eval. I think that was the core of a lot of what the judge relied on. And that had many things such as psychiatric consultation, taking the medications for that, individual therapy and the like. The only one the court found was the ARMS that had been fully complied with. Not fully utilizing the home services, the inconsistent follow through on visitation, the prioritizing the abusive and bad relationships, and the health concerns for the children. Two hospitalizations for failure to thrive, where once the child was in the hospital, just a short period, it quickly gained weight. The burns, the vape pen drinking. So there were multiple incidents, which goes to something in appellant's reply brief about just a single occurrence. That's not what's going on here. There's multiple acts of putting the children in harm's way. The appellant's main argument seems to be the logical inconsistency between the parental duties factor and the palpably unfit factor. I note that what the court did not find that the mother met her parental duties. The court found at number 7 that the petitioner failed to prove that factor. And that's a whole different thing. Failing to prove does not prove that the other is true, the other being that she was fulfilling her parental duties. And because otherwise, as I argued in the brief, what you would have is you'd have two separate statutory factors that would only ever mean one thing. They have different elements, different requirements, and it leads to whatever the petitioner establishes. Regarding the romantic partners, it was said an argument here about it was the number. Looking at the court's finding number 17, it says the mom continues to devote much of her energy into her romantic relationships with unsafe characters. And that's the key. It's about the quality of the individuals, not the number. She's not judging that. It's more about choosing individuals, two different individuals who've had their own rights to their children limited or prohibited in certain ways. Court found that to be a problem, that mom's exposing the kids to these individuals who are not safe for their own kids. the pride that the appellant took on Facebook that she was dating her first drug dealer before age 20. That's a problem. The abusiveness of the one individual, Mr. Andreessen, and another individual, she didn't even know why he had gotten out of prison, just let him into the house. Those were the problems the court had with the relationships. Also, in the findings, and that comes up more in the reply brief, attacking more like the number of visitations, it wasn't as unattended as claimed. I submit that this is where we come headlong into the standard of review. It's an abuse of discretion, findings that need to shown to be clearly erroneous. And at most, the appellant is arguing their own case again that was made at the district court, or in one instance, citing to the petitioner's petition. Recent Court of Appeals decision found that a problem to when the county relies on a petition to establish facts. So I think that should not be given great weight here. And I think it's important to know that the district court's in the best position to assess credibility, and the court here did make a specific finding regarding mom's complete lack of credibility. I think that's important to determine what's in the record, that the court frequently will discount the efforts or the statements of the mom. With regards to reasonable efforts, the court did not just make a laundry list of this thing, this thing, this thing. The court's findings went into great detail on what those reasonable efforts and why they affected the case. I note one was parental capacity evaluation. I think there are there are several pages, although it's just two findings of fact, where the court outlines what the recommendations were in the parental capacity, why they were not followed. And within that, the judge cites a lot of the failures to follow through on the appointments, et cetera. I think there's a degree of futileness of the efforts too. For example, the appellant herself had the job, but she failed to keep it from her own failure to follow through with paperwork. I think more importantly throughout all this is the issue on the insurance. It was the appellant herself who let that lapse, and that could have helped covered so many things. And the social worker did remind her over and over again, you need to get this filled out to have these services available to you. But it was the appellant herself who let them lapse.
Can I interrupt and just ask a quick question? So the TPR petition, the judge ruled on that appellant was palpably unfit, as opposed to, or the county didn't bring a claim, I guess, under subdivision 1B clause 5, just that reasonable efforts have failed. So what is the palpable unfitness? What are we to focus on here? Is it the hospitalizations for the two children prior to the opening of the child protection case? Because that, otherwise the rest of it just seems to be, you know, failure of reasonable effort by the county.
I would submit that it's all of it together. I think the key is the health related issues, that over and over the mom was putting the children in dangerous health situations, whether it's drinking vape pen juice that caused a hospitalization, whether it's the negligence or failure to supervise that caused the burns, whether it's failure to properly feed the child that he had to be hospitalized twice. And then upon hospitalization, that the child quickly, at least I think that was the second time they noted, it gained 8 ounces in a couple days. So it's with that, and then that's where you have these other issues that fit in with that, with the lack of insight into her own parenting skills, ability to maintain employment, whether to take advantage of, I think more importantly than the employment, is the individual therapy. That dealt with the individuals that mom was letting into the kids' lives. And the focus of why that wasn't recommended by the parental capacity evaluation. I think that's what deals with the palpable unfitness at its core. Last issue is on the judicial notice. Kind of the court's questions, I think, where I was coming from, which was, this is an extra rule. There's a general judicial notice rule, but there's a special juvenile protection judicial notice rule. It doesn't engraft an additional requirement of it being a final order. It's simply, and I think the Supreme Court, in adopting these rules and in the efforts in formulating the rules, would have had that, would be aware of this being a different rule than the that applies in any other civil case. And they chose to make it more expansive. And that would conclude my argument. Yes.
Judge Larkin, can I ask a question? Do you agree with Mr. Mack that the CHIPS order was not a final order at the time judicial notice was taken?
The CHIPS order that would be final would be the dispositional order.
Is that the order which order did the district court take judicial notice of?
It wasn't that one. It was intermediate dispositional orders. Just give me a moment. I have it right here. Okay. It's under finding of fact number 9. There's a permanency progress review. So that would have been about 6 months into the case, the child protection matter.
And when was the final dispositional order in the CHIPS case, the order adjudicating the kids' CHIPS?
Let's see, I don't have that off the top. Did I address that in procedural history?
Well, that's okay. Was it more than 20 days prior to the district court's taking of judicial notice of underlying orders?
Yes.
Do you recall if the court administrator provided a service of notice of the issuance of that order adjudicating the kids' CHIPS?
I don't recall that. I know that's the standard practice, and we certainly, our county was one of the ones where we had the issue of serving the attorneys at the child protection matter, but then closing out their representation.
Right.
And when that had to get addressed,
so that we changed
leaving
the
them
rule
on the case. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had that problem. So, but I don't know for sure.
Understood. All right. Thank you.
Let's see other hearings, just to fully answer the question. Oh, wow. That's extensive.
Well, and you don't need to search. And perhaps Mr. Mack can address this. As I understand Mr. Mack's argument, it's that we shouldn't take judicial notice of an order that's not final because it's subject to appeal and it could be determined to be an error. And that's a reasonable argument.
Right.
However, Mr. Mack also seems to argue that, well, an order adjudicating a child CHIPS is not a final order because there could end up being permanency proceedings, and then it would be the final last order resolving the permanency proceedings, which is the appeal from which the order from which appeal can be taken. But there's no rule that says that. Instead, what the rule says is appeal may be taken from any final order. The deadline for filing an appeal is 20 days from the district court's provision of service of notice of filing of the order. In other words, we no longer require the parties to serve notice in order to trigger the appeal time because of the expedited timeline. So if the district court issued an order adjudicating the kids' CHIPS, the district court administrator provided service of that notice on the lawyers and parties, then under the rules, the parties would have had 20 days to file notice of appeal. And I guess I will ask Mr. Mack why, if those things happen here, that underlying CHIPS adjudication order was not final 20 days after service of notice.
Just following up, since this kind of flows from some of this conversation, is the procedure for challenging judicial notice facts too could have came up during the trial itself. And it says it can be, the challenge can be made at any stage. And here that was not done.
Which rule are you citing or quoting?
I believe that's within the general judicial notice rule 301, I think is where I'm getting that from.
Do you have the site handy for the relevant rule of juvenile protection procedure?
The juvenile rule is 302. But I believe what I'm talking about comes through the general judicial notice order. So here, the court during the testimony, or just right after mom's testimony, said that she was going to take judicial notice. The court got more specific in its findings. And certainly at that point, the parties could have also made challenges to that. Or even during the hearing, asked for what specifically the court was going to take notice of. That did not take place here either. So seems like that was another time where a challenge could have been made. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions. So now, Mr. Mack, we'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Yes, let me go to one place that was only briefly touched on by the county, and that relates to MAH. MAH is living with the father. Every single danger the county attempted to paint simply isn't there with regard to that child. The mother visits the child with no problems, and most importantly, the father does not object. It seems to me that if you have a situation where one of the parties to a parent-child relationship has no problem with the mother continuing her parental rights, that probably should be dispositive. And if it isn't dispositive, at least you should ask the father, because he has to have a lot of input into this sort of thing. If the mother is visiting the child without problems, he's going to want to have his child in a position where the mother's Social Security could kick in, where the mother's other rights under federal and state law help the child. And so unless you have a determination by the father that, look, I want her parental rights terminated, that should be, if not dispositive, at least of extreme importance. Now,
Mr. Mack, are you saying that we should defer to the other parent to decide whether or not one parent's rights should be terminated rather than have the district court make that determination?
Yes, at least the district court should have asked the father, what do you want to do on this? Because it's very important in a case like this where you aren't going to have adoption, where you're going to have the same thing going on that's been going on for the last 3 years, and there's no indication of abuse of MAH, that I think the court has to consider what the father wants and the ongoing relationship with the father. And
what's your case law or statutory support for that position?
Well, I'm not sure that there would be case law on it, because this is a fairly unique kind of situation. There are cases where, of course, one of the parents is determined to be subject to a TPR and the other isn't. But in almost all of the cases that I've had involving that, the other parent favors the TPR. That's not the case that we have here. Why should we take away an existing arrangement that's working when we aren't going to adopt the child out? Oh, you're muted, Judge.
Oh, thank you. As I understand your argument, it's like, why should we take away the relationship? In other words, why should we eliminate visitation between mother and father that father is willing to allow?
Well, it's stronger than that. Why? It's not just taking away visitation, it's taking away the whole relationship and the ability of the father and the child to have a relationship with the mother that's non-problematical.
What prevents father and child from having a relationship with mother if father, as the custodial parent, wants to do so? In other words, mother doesn't have any right to visitation, but I'm not sure that there's anything that legally prevents father from allowing mother to see the child. Of course, if he does so under circumstances that endanger the child, he might find himself back in child protection court. But I mean, it seems to me your client has a perfect situation. Even though her rights have been terminated, the child's custodial parent is willing to allow her to be involved in the child's life. Normally, the county is not so accepting of such arrangements.
Well, here's the problem with that. The child is going to know as the child gets older that mom's parental rights have been terminated, that she is not allowed to necessarily have any visitation with mother, that any contact with the child is purely at the behest of the father, and that she has second-class relationships with a person who ought to be her mother and who was her mother. I think that this causes, potentially with the child, a demeaning of the relationship, that mother is a second-class citizen, that mother is a bad mother. All these things tell the child the wrong thing. Thank you.
Mr. Mack, would you agree that, let's assume for the sake of argument, that two parents have termination of parental rights petitions brought against both parents, that the district court would evaluate each parent separately rather than evaluating both of them together?
I think they have to do both. I think they have to evaluate them separately. Of course they do. But they also have to, in the best interest of the child, look at the whole relationship.
But when you look at the best interest of the child, you look at the relationship between the child and the parent, not the parents.
Well, the best relationship of the best interest of the child, however, relates to her total relationships, including her relationship with the mother, her relationship with the father, and the relation of the mother and father to each other. It's very broad. Best interests, I think, encompasses entire relationships. And I think here you have to look at the entire relationship.
All right, counsels, thank you for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within the expedited timeline provided for in our court's appellate rules. And that concludes the court's oral calendar this morning. We will now proceed with our non-oral cases. Be heard at 11 o'clock. See you then.